And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and it gives us a great pleasure today to welcome back to Dads on the Air, Anthony Smith. Anthony has established a national profile in men's issues across men's health, suicide prevention and re-employment for mature-aged men. Anthony has authored and co-authored papers and reports on men and suicide, recently with lead author Dr. John Ashfield and Professor John McDonald. In March 2018, Anthony was a speaker at the symposium organised by the Men's Health Information and Resource Centre of Western Sydney University on the topic, Can Australia's Suicide Rates Be Lowered? A Situational Approach to Suicide Prevention. Anthony, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Thanks, sir. Thank you.
So, Anthony, at a time when, on average, 8 people a day are taking their lives by suicide in Australia and worldwide, suicide kills more than war, homicide, famine. The governments and communities are starting to acknowledge the problem. But do you think they're going down the wrong track?
Oh, yes, totally. I mean, what we're doing and what we've been doing for the last decade and a half is pouring more and more money into an approach that clearly is not working. The more money we put in, the more the suicide rates continue to rise, both men and women, mostly men, but the numbers of women who are killing themselves is rising also. And unless we have, I think, a broad-scale change to how we address this, it's not going to change. We're just going to keep pouring money into ineffective approaches to this.
Well, you hear people say, oh, he killed himself, he must have been depressed. Is that perhaps where we need to start rethinking our approach?
Yeah, yes, that's one of the key things to this. Now, I'm not saying that, I'm not discounting that people aren't suffering. You know, that's clearly the case. But to reduce it to a simplistic idea of a clinical depression and with the idea that if we can just treat that depression, is not going to help. And for a lot of men, pushing them in that direction, that is, you know, go and talk to somebody, go and talk to your GP about your depression, is not only not helpful, there's good evidence that adds to the challenges they're facing in their life. Let's begin to look at what the issues are that are causing them the distress in the first place.
And you're distinguishing there between distress and depression. Seems to me, from your papers, you're saying distress is almost like a human condition, a normal human condition, but depression should be treated as something different again, shouldn't it?
You know, what we've done, we've got this ambiguous thing when we refer to depression. And again, I'm not saying that some people don't find themselves in a debilitating state, but even that is not necessarily a clinical, you know, a clinical condition. Because the whole so-called science behind the categorisation of clinical depression is really questionable. It's the biomedical approach. You know, there must be some brain disorder, and within that we can therefore treat that disorder with drugs that change that chemical imbalance. You know, the supposed chemical imbalance in the brain. Yeah, we've got to step right away from that. It's just not helpful for the majority of cases.
And the costs are enormous, aren't they? I mean, depression seems to use... Every time you pick up the paper, you read someone, high-profile figure or someone's got depression, and it just makes you wonder.
Well, it does. And what's going on is this whole idea, I call it an ideology of depression. You know, I'm starting to use the language around default depression. No matter what the causes are, oh, it must be depression. And it's not just in our general community, and you know, suicide prevention and mental health that this is so prevalent now, it's actually become institutionalised. So even in the workplace where, you know, we have escalating claims for so-called mental disorders, and I've got a, there's a fantastic WorkSafe document that's been produced on this 2015, you know, $480 million of claims for mental disorder in a year. But when you look at the breakdown of those claims, about 90% of them are things that have got nothing to do with a precondition that we might say is a, you know, a genuine mental health disorder. Most of them are from things like workplace bullying, workplace conditions of work, overwork, violence in the workplace, etc. That's out in the public domain. But you see that use of language between page 2 of the document, mental disorders, and page 4 where it's broken down. They're still called mental disorders, but they're in fact things that have got very little to do with the internal psychological, emotional challenges from a biological perspective of these people. They are clearly distressed because of external pressures.
And equally clearly, I mean, you're not going to treat bullying by giving the person drugs, are you? Which is just, on common sense grounds, doesn't seem to be the right approach.
These drugs are very, very harmful, these antidepressants. There's a lot of published research about the sorts of harms from these drugs. So not only are we not helping the person, man or woman or child, large numbers of children, 560,000 children now on antidepressants in Australia, large numbers. So we funnel them to the GP, who's got very little option but to diagnose them with depression and prescribe these harsh drugs. And then the people have to deal with the difficult side effects.
There are the medical side effects, and once you're on a plan, there are other consequences as well. I mean, I think, say, employment. I mean, I have a friend who applied for the police, but he didn't want to disclose that he'd had treatment for mental problems, and so he didn't disclose it. And, I mean, once you're diagnosed, that's could stop you getting a job or all sorts of other consequences, couldn't it?
Oh, that's a very important point, Bill, yes. I mean, there's all this guff that's paid for with large amounts of money about the whole idea of destigmatising. Make no mistake, the stigma is still very, very strong, and people are in very difficult circumstances as to, as you rightly point out there, declaring that they've been diagnosed with a depression. They carry that with them for the rest of their life. This is considered to be a mental disorder. Yeah, so as you say, there are social implications as well as the very serious biological implications from these diagnoses and prescribing of harsh antidepressant drugs.
Perhaps could you define for us what is actually meant by depression, or people say clinical depression? What is the difference between that and just, say, feeling sad because of events in life?
You know, again, you're raising a very important point, and it's a very relevant question because the ambiguity is so great that it's hard to make that distinction. When you look through the literature, I've been trying to do some writing now, it's grey and murky everywhere. And in fact, the specific definitions have changed over time. And there's good published research showing that the way the definitions of clinical depression have changed have actually suited the marketing of antidepressant drugs over the last 4, 5, 6 decades. So what is the difference? Well, it depends which book you pick up and look at the definition. I think it's, what we're trying to do with the situational approach is just put aside those clinical definitions altogether and look, you know, rather we would focus on what's causing that person to be distressed in the first place.
Yes, and that's the situational approach. And there are other things to look at than just ascribing everything to depression, and and then of course there is that risk if everything is labelled as depression, that you'll go down that wrong path that we were just talking about, where you're on drugs and you're labelled, and there are all these other consequences from this wrong description. So we're speaking today with Anthony Smith, and we're talking on a new approach to suicide prevention in Australia. A situational approach is the term that was coined by our guest, Anthony Smith, and two co-authors. We might take a short break here now. Anthony, we ask our guests to pick a song. Would you like to tell us which song you picked and why you picked it?
Yeah, I think it's called Pass the Bottle. Is it the Devil's Daughter?
Yeah, great name for a band.
I've been looking at a range of material, clips on the YouTube, and I love this one.
Just a bottle of wine and my baby and me. Borrowed your daddy's brand new Cadillac. If the barn's not open, we'll sneak in the back. Tip that bottle and roll the hay. Head back home, you remember the way we're going.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, yeah.
It's gonna be great, I just can't wait. Meet me in the barn about half past eight. We'll get all lit up when you pass that bottle to me. Pass that bottle to me, yeah.
Yes, that was Pass That Bottle by the Devil's Daughters. I think it's a great name for a band. And it was chosen for us today by our special guest, Anthony Smith. And we're talking today about a situational approach to suicide prevention. So, Anthony, we've just been talking about going down that wrong path and ascribing everything to depression. Your new approach is to look at the situation rather than just the depression, as however it's defined, as a mental illness.
For example, you know, a clear example of what we would call the situational approach is that, simply put, the majority of people in Australia, of those 3,000 plus a year who kill themselves, are not employed. And we have that data from the National Coronial Information System, which uses exactly the same coronial data as the ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics. But, if we want to address that toll of suicide deaths, surely we're going to have to do something about the large numbers of people who are not employed who kill themselves. There would be a good start.
Yes, some of those factors, of course, are a lot more difficult to deal with than just, say, prescribing drugs. I mean, you mentioned, yes, people who are unemployed, you've got relationship breakdowns or other situational approaches I think you've addressed. It's not going to be easy to resolve those issues, is it?
Oh, no, you're right. It will be very, very difficult because it will mean, reviewing deeply established political and bureaucratic structures that favour the simplistic idea of, well, maybe they're depressed. So you're right. However, if we want to try and arrest this increase in suicide deaths, we really are going to have to bite the bullet and go for a significant change in the way we do this. And that change includes, this is one of the strongest things I say, stepping aside from the favoured so-called experts of the last decade and a half, couple of decades, and bringing in some new people with some new ideas, because clearly those favoured experts, they've done well out of this, no problem in the world, you know, established large research organisations and training programs. They've done very, very well out of this, but they haven't been able to reduce the number of suicide deaths. Not only have they not been able to reduce them, they keep growing.
There is an incentive to look at something else, even on the financial basis, because the cost of the current treatment, I've seen figures as high as 4% of GDP, which is a massive number, isn't it? Apart from
huge
the other costs.
Amounts. Yeah, huge amounts of money this costs. And like I gave that example with the insurance claims for mental disorder, these figures are escalating to the extent that the insurance industry is actually itself, the whole industry, vulnerable to a collapse in the way it's done, because the costs are escalating the more and more we direct people who are in any sort of distress in the workplace to consult with a GP, where the outcome is most likely to be a diagnosis of depression or anxiety disorder. And then things like income protection come into play. And this is an enormous cost on that industry. So yeah, it's you know, of national economic proportion.
And the problem may even be bigger than we suspect, because when you look at the suicide statistics, I sometimes wonder if they include things like, you know, single driver accident collisions, you know, people drive into trees and things where may not be described as suicide, but it may very well be that.
Yeah, and you're right. Generally agreed, you know, even in the pro-medicalised approach to suicide, there's about a 20 to 30% underreporting of suicide deaths in Australia. So that's probably another, you know, 500 or 600 a year. That's generally agreed. And again, many of those are men. So you give that example of the single vehicle, single occupant car accident where there's no other, you know, no engineering faults or no weather faults or anything like that, and the majority of those won't be classed as suicides, but it is suspected that they are. Another example is deliberate overdoses. Won't be classed as a suicide, but likely that it was a suicide. So yes, I mean the figures are even higher.
And I think you mentioned at one stage there the difference between the male and the suicide rate. Do you think we need to be gender-specific when talking about suicide? Because I think currently they get some sort of differential treatment.
Well, we do. Absolutely we do. Because, again, you know, like I'm giving the example of the unemployed people, if we don't consider the gender differences, for example, in how men deal with stress or how men cope with emotions, and there's huge amount of evidence about the difference between those sorts of things, then again, we're not really going to make an impact on the actual total toll of deaths for suicide. Men do deal with stress differently to women. It's not right or wrong or better or worse, but it is different and needs to be considered.
Now, Anthony, you've recently addressed a conference on this topic of can Australia's suicide rate be lowered. I'm just wondering if the answer is yes, and if what you see as the priorities if we're going to do this.
Well, like I was just saying a little earlier, really we'll need to bite the bullet and make some very strong decisions about how we approach this differently. We will need to reconsider where we put our funding for our program delivery and our research. And we're now talking about large amounts of money here. we'll need to reconsider who we take advice from in terms of consulting so-called experts. We really will need to redress the way programs are delivered at the community level and ensure that what is delivered genuinely reflects the truth of the data rather than, and you know, I've sat in seminars where the same sorts of misinformation is promulgated time after time without question. You know, an example would be the whole emphasis rural suicide rates are 2.5 times metropolitan rates, for example. And there's a terrible state going on in rural communities, and we need to keep supporting them as best we can. But the idea of the 2.5 times metropolitan death rates is really a misinformation, because there are specific localities in specific areas of our metropolitan areas that have very, very high suicide rates. Mm. And you can show them, you can map them against, for example, where there's high rates of unemployment. And so that, like the unemployment thing, the majority of all our suicide deaths in this country happen in just the six major capital cities. So, you know, we need to make sure that the basic information that's going out to communities actually really is appropriate and is genuinely based on the evidence that we've got.
And I guess it should be targeted in the sense that we know the Indigenous rate of suicide as a whole is very high, but I think you point out that in some areas, Indigenous communities, it's not necessarily high, so it needs to be more focused.
Well, it does, yeah. You know, there can't be horses for courses. I mean, there has to be horses for courses here, as they say. Different areas, and that's why I say, you know, there is a mapping that's available in the public domain, the Torrens University, and you can map a whole range of health data, including suicide deaths, by local government area and by electorate, for example, for every part of Australia. And it's a really instructional thing to do, because you can see that whether it's within metropolitan areas or country areas, side-by-side electorates and local government areas can have very, very different rates of suicide deaths. And so you just simply can't generalise this like we have been.
There really is a need to start doing something about this with this escalating and horrific cost of the suicide. It seems to me that we've got to make a number of changes. We've got to change at perhaps the government, the community level, but even in little things like language. I think we need to, from what you're saying, is we need to change the language of whether it's depression or distress, and get some of the stigmas out of the way so we can actually start doing some real work in the area.
Yeah, you're spot on there, Bill. You know, that is one of the fundamental things. As I say, you know, what do we mean when we say something like mental disorder? You know, the example I gave earlier of the WorkSafe Australia thing. On the one hand, they talk about mental disorder. On the other hand, when you break it down, it's not mental disorder at all. It's genuine human distress as a result of very, very stressful circumstances that anybody would find difficult. So, yes, language is fundamentally important here. I would try and avoid even the term mental health. I mean, what does that mean, mental health? You know, are we talking about the mental health system when we say mental health? Are we talking about the implied mental ill health? That sort of language gets used to help, as I say, the entrenched vested interests of those organisations who do very well out of the current approach.
There's a lot of work to do. It's very timely that we get onto it. And as you've heard from our guest today, Anthony Smith, there are some clear directions which should be going in, which is not necessarily what we're doing at the moment. If this program has raised any concerns, please contact Lifeline on 131114. Or the Suicide Callback Service on 1300 659 467. And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. So it just remains for me now, Anthony Smith. Anthony, thank you very much for being a guest and being so providing so much information to us on this very important topic.
Yeah, thanks very much, Bill. I do appreciate the opportunity, and I respect, you know, the fact that you're soldiering on in trying to help the community in generally reconsider some of the presumed ways of doing things that we have.
Thank you for that, Anthony, and we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.